Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
I'm best described in some ways as, in old-fashioned terms, as a copywriter. So somebody who works in an advertising agency and scribbles out ideas for, you know, press, poster, TV, digital, whatever. I don't do that anymore, really. Not quite like that. But that's a way of understanding, you know, what I do, really. And it's now called content production, and which is basically the same thing. Can you find something interesting to say around a product or service that you're selling so that it helps it in a strategic way, so that it helps people get interested in it or engage with it? So it's strategic content. And I guess when I joined advertising, you know, the industry, it was something that happened in a building, you know, you and it was a type of person that went into it, and it was a professional network. And now it's a bit more loose than that, and things happen in a different sort of way. So that's essentially the sort of skills that I, since then I've sort of taught myself a bunch of video skills, because actually the word only gets you so far, and the video is so important. So I use video quite a lot now, like you do, really, I guess. And I guess like you, just finding interesting things that people are saying around products or services that, you know, have commercial needs, commercial goals. So that pretty much describes what I'm up to.
And do you find that when people are coming to you to ask for advice, are you almost having to do the running them through this part and they're convincing them at the beginning? Or do you find that they just kind of get it? I don't know, what are the trends that you are seeing?
People always want results, and whatever gives a result is fine. But actually, I've been working with a partner who's a small strategic partner, and she's saying, well, you know, Google is now penalizing wherever it sees ChatGPT. So there is a direct commercial answer to that question, which is that if you're not bringing something creatively to that situation, then you're not actually adding any value, and therefore you won't be successful. So the commercial bottom line is, you know, it won't wash. I think it comes back to, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool with people all the time. And you can't fool really Google all the time either. And then you can't get results all the time. So you do have to do it. I think there is something to be said for doing things the right way, which is going back to an authentic human experience and working from that, if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, definitely. And when you're talking to kind of leaders, and that you're almost trying to convince them of that part of the kind of, we need to bring back authenticity into what we do, is there a way that almost you're posing that to them? Is there a question that you think they should be asking themselves that they're not currently?
Right now is in some ways just an extension of what's always been the case, which is, I mean, the most obvious question, if you've got a leader in some kind of business situation, what they want is more bums on seats and more, you know, footfall into their organization. Sometimes they want just happier regulators. And the most obvious question is, how can we get a better idea of what the end user actually wants? How can we get better connected with what the end user actually wants? And that requires a human connection with that end user, because the world is full of examples of brands now that are losing it because they've over-automated, and their chats, their automatic chat systems are handling all the call inquiries. And people want an authentic, they want an authentic human experience, not just because it's human, because it actually works, because you and I know that if we've got a problem with some washing machine that hasn't been delivered, getting onto a how can I help you little, you know, chat system, unless our problem is really mainstream, and often it isn't, which is why it's a problem in the first place, that computer is not going to be able to solve it. You know, when can I talk to a human is the question that comes up first. So the question that comes up is, I always think, it's a very simple one, is let's get real. Let's remember that we are talking to human beings, and we need to find, none of us around this room have got a very good idea of what our actual customer is experiencing when they meet us, our product, for the first time. We're bought into this organization. We're being paid by it. We see it every day. We are surrounded by it. We breathe it. We take its money. We take its, you know, its car park. It's, we live with it. And, but somebody coming to it cold, you know, does, you know, has a very different experience and things, and it's not working for them. So we need to go and ask them what their world is like, and work backwards from there. So, I mean, in the past, I've worked with a bunch of organizations that all really wanted to do something better for some reason, one way or another. And they knew at some level they needed to achieve that. One of them, for example, was a water authority that, you know, had a very poor kind of relationship with its customers, which the regulator knew about. They ultimately weren't bothered as long as the regulator wasn't too bothered. But at some point, the regulator did get bothered. I mean, now the kind of breakdown in the relationship between Joe Public and the water system, the water boards, is very evident. And it's quite depressing, the disconnect between the real human experience and what these organizations thought they were producing. So they were producing, for example, we talk about following the science and scientific data, you know, facts, but none of these were true. You know, they were producing water quality data that the public going swimming in these rivers said, that's not true. We don't believe that data. So they started collecting their own data. Joe Public, doing their own swimming in their own rivers and lakes, started collecting their own data and saying, look, that's the amount of basically fecal matter, poo in the water that you're pumping out. And we don't care what you're telling us, because that is what we found on Tuesday at 11 o'clock. And that is, so there was a breakdown in there. And that comes back. So that breakdown, we know well from reading newspapers how that came about in terms of privatizations and things like that. But I would say from a communications point of view, there's something else you can say about it, which is it also comes from an organization that is used to being a ruler. And one of the things that you do when you work with brands and communication is you ask, well, what is the kind of role of this product or the voice? What's the style of voice that's going on? You know, is it a ruler, for example? Is it shut up and listen to me while I talk, for example? Or is it, you know, a creative, like, I wonder how this could be done in a more interesting way, or wonder if the moon were made of cheese, or, you know, or is it an explorer? What lies beyond there? What is it, a joke, or somebody's just having a laugh, but understanding the world probably needs to stay in the same place? There's a very brilliant scheme of archetypes that was sort of, I think it was founded by Jung, but developed by Mark, who wrote a book called The Hero and the Outlaw, and it just talks about 12 archetypes that you can sort of see operating lots of brands. And one of the things that became very clear to me was that water boards wanted to be your friend at one point. This was a little project for them. They wanted to be your friend. They wanted to talk to you like an equal. But fundamentally, they were a ruler, right? And that sounds a bit abstract, you know, and like, well, what do you mean by all this? And actually, it came down to something incredibly simple. I said things to them like, well, you know, when somebody isn't in, and you write them a letter saying you weren't in, so we switched your water off. We knocked on your door, you weren't there, so we've had to switch your water off. So we've decided to switch your water off. That's the kind of thing a ruler does, because they have complete control of the system, right? They don't say, so we'd like to make another appointment, so we'll try again. If we don't succeed, then we're concerned about this. That would be what a caregiver would do. But when you're a ruler, you naturally, if you don't get what you want first time, you revert your ruler habits, right? And you just switch the water off. And sooner or later, they'll come running. You know, where's our water? Right, okay, you haven't paid your bill, or we couldn't get to speak to you about this. So what I noticed was a lot of organizations revert to their normal type, the type that's given by their market condition. You know, if they're, you know, essentially a monopoly, then they're going to be a ruler. If they're properly competing in a marketplace, then they generally aren't a ruler, you know. And but so around 2005, I found myself, you know, a lot of organizations wanted to be more friendly, and so you find yourself working, you know, some brand, you know, writing and doing, asking questions around brand, but you realize that they fundamentally, it's very, very difficult for them to switch, because, you know, they may want to be friendly, they may have to persuade the regulator they're actually friendly and they're more can do and connect with their customer client base, but they can't do it because their natural propensity is to natural tendency is to say, you know, shut up and listen to me, or we'll switch you off, and when you're starving, come back and we'll see if we change our opinion, our ruling on you, because that's what rulers do.
So in that case, then, almost, you know, let's say a brand's coming to you, and they are wanting to have a different tone of voice than what, you know, naturally comes out. Are you more likely to kind of work through that with them and go, okay, so you would have to do A, B, C and make a lot of big changes? Or are you likely to be like, okay, let's be realistic, let's be authentic. Realistically, you're going to be not doing these kind of things. Where do you stand on that then?
That's right. Yeah, well, now I am much more like, you know, you're naturally this. You know, you've got to acknowledge what you naturally are, because, you can start by a blue sky exercise, which is, who would you like to sound like? You know, what sort of things would you like to be? I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate thing. How far you get there, down that line, is the success rate is, yeah, you the success rate will, you know, is a lot of, you know, brand refreshes don't really work, or they don't persuade people very far for very long, but at least it's fun trying, you know, at least you can explore and try and be something else for a bit, you know, like wearing fancy dress for a bit, you know. But yeah, one of the exercises I've figured out with a colleague a while back, another sort of ruler organization, which was an insurance company located in Switzerland, and it was very clear that, you know, they wanted to explore different tones of, you know, they wanted to start communicating at a level that they hadn't really communicated. They were famous for being sort of a bit dark and quiet, and in the absence of any communication, people always assumed the worst thing. So they assumed that this Swiss company had basically taken lots of Nazi gold and, you know, made their fortune that way. So that's the in the absence of communication, people think about the worst thing. So they were also aware that they wanted to, you know, to communicate more and better and all that stuff. And so we did a brand exercise where we talked to the top guy and said, look, this is 10 different ways we can express, just say something about what you do. And which do you like? You know, which is you? And and that was the first time I'd ever tried that exercise, actually writing a tone of voice, you know, synthetically to test out what was actually going on. So I sat down with my colleague and we did it pretty much like an IKEA kitchen. You know, you go to IKEA and you can have the classic, you know, Victorian, or you can have the, you know, modern Scandinavian kitchen, or you see a little, and of course the pipes don't work, and, you know, you don't turn on water, no, the water doesn't come out, but you can see what the look and feel of the kitchen's like. We did the same with coffee, just a few, and it was very interesting. We we did this exercise and we determined a sort of a sort of copy style for them, which we called the style of international management bollocks, actually, because it actually was very good at not, it sounded like a management consultant, but not really, it never really said very much. So it would, it always used a set of three words where one would do. We identify, determine, and deliver the key essential components for, a whatever it is. So that was very much the identify, determine, and deliver key. The word key is very important because nothing's key, because you find this whole bunch of ticks where nothing's really prioritized, but the key appears everywhere. So anyway, you like that style. And we wrote a whole bunch of communication in that style. And he loved the exercise, but realized we needed to find something proper to say, which was kind of where the real human experience, and that was the bit that had been missing in the conversation with him up to then. So it was a very useful exercise, and it shows the kind of problems that organizations have in communicating, who they are and what they are. I mean, another organization that I got involved with was the British Museum, actually, and that also had a problem communicating what it was. This was around 2005, and I was asked to help create a cash box just to deliver some, revenue for the organization. I think everyone knew a cash box was never going to solve the financial problems of the British Museum, but it was an interesting little mini exercise that I could be put to work on. And it also raised a very important identity question, because if you think about a cash box or any kind of like, here, please give us some money, give us some money, because the first question you ask is, well, who are you? If a beggar comes up to you in the street, well, they're a beggar, but you know that their identity is given by their homelessness, if you like. But if somebody asks you, to give money, the question is, well, what am I giving money for? What is it? What? And at the time, that was a big issue for the British Museum, because it had a bit of an identity crisis. It was seen as an organization that just took other people's belongings from around the world and stuck them in, and then just held on to them. So the challenge was, well, it's got to be a bit more exciting than that. It's got to be a bit more than that. What could it be? And the extra level of challenge was, there was this perception that we could not use the word culture. And so the challenge was, how do you write about what the British Museum does and is without using the word culture? And I found that nigh on impossible, actually, because it's not a history museum. It's not an art gallery. But it is about culture. If you don't use the word culture, what is it that it is? But as a result of that sort of inquiry, it ultimately became, produced the exhibition, The History of the World in 100 Objects, because that was a way of saying, look, what we do is culture, without using the word culture, if that makes sense. So that's the kind of origin of that whole, exhibition idea was the history of the museum, the history of the world in 100 objects, because that was a way of saying, look, we do world culture without using the word culture. But I think now if you look at the British Museum, they do use the word culture. If you look at their mission statement, they've allowed themselves that word. But museums are another example of organizations that have quite a lot of bits of neuroses that get in the way and make communication with the public difficult. They need it. They need the public to love them. They need the public to interact with them. But they have lots of, mental, little blocks that get in the way of, just like, the kid that doesn't have friends, because he takes their lunch or whatever. There are things that we do or the organizations do that prevent the connection of themselves to the public that on which they depend. So I suppose the answer to your question, what do you often find yourself saying, is how can we get connected? How can we get connected to the people that we're supposed to be serving? you know? And it was, it's such a fundamental question. There's, you know, it's not difficult, you know, what I do, what anyone does that's involved in ultimately, you know, tuning up an organization's communications. It comes down to that. How can you get connected to the people that you're serving better and more authentically? And probably the most famous example of this idea was given by, I think, by Steve Jobs in a video which most people have seen because I assume it's so viral, but if you haven't, definitely worth checking out. But he literally picks up a chair and protects himself from a very aggressive question that comes from the back of the audience. Like, would you mind telling me exactly, Mr. Jobs, what you've been doing for the last 5 years? And it was a question basically said, you know, why aren't you being more techy? Where's all the tech innovation going? What are you doing with all this tech? And Steve Jobs basically said, look, it's the technology is only a means to deliver what public need. You've got to ask what's in their world, what do they need? What's going to make their world better? How can tech be used to solve that problem? Work it that way around, not the other way around. And I think it's no surprise that he delivered a massive creative, you know, leap forward in so many fronts because he is fundamentally connected to that priority.
I think it's incredible that, you know, when we first hear about kind of what you do and it's all about kind of content and the way things are worded and presented, it seems like it's very how we're going to present ourselves to outwardly. But then I feel like the more I'm hearing from you and the more kind of more things you're saying, what you're really doing is just how the building a connection, really. It's not just one way. It's definitely a two-way system. And it's kind of, okay, so who are we as a business, really? And how are we connecting with kind of our clients, our consumers, our customers? And then how do we almost facilitate that? How do we make that more authentic and in a way that doesn't seem fake?
Well, people spot fakeness very, very quickly. I think that's why we all hate these chatbots. You know, we sense there's something, you know, that's just missing there. But of course, and I suppose when you think of writers, you think of, or business writers, you think of like it's a transmission process of these are the words that we're sending out to the universe. But actually, the best words are actually expressing what's on the consumer's mind, that they acknowledge the proper fears and anxieties and desires of the consumer, and they can meet them, you know. And that is I guess what content is about, because you know that's the human condition. We are all about words and meanings and feelings and emotions. And there's this world of products, things that at a basic level we need water, we need food, we need electricity, but we have all sorts of feelings about all these products. And you know, there's always surprising words and ideas and thoughts that are associated with all of those products, which constantly change. You can assume that you know what they stand for, all of the products that we buy and use and services we use, that we can assume you know what they stand for. But it's only when you actually ask people, well, you know, with a one-on-one interview, that you actually get to find out what they're really about. And that's what really good communications people do. They, you know, there was this, I think around the 80s, there was the beginnings of what called the planning discipline. And that was people who actually interrogated, you know, a product and people and understood what was important in it that made that product what it was. That's an unchanging aspect of communication. That never changes, really.
I guess kind of on that note, I know that, you know, we're running a little bit out of time, but what we like to do at the end of these podcasts is ask you a few quick fire questions. We know a lot about kind of what you do and a lot about your ideas, but we think at Label Sessions it's important to know a little bit about you as well.
Sure.
Question one, number one of quick fire questions. Do you think that your friends and family could explain what you do well?
probably no and yes. They know what I used to do, but like we were saying earlier, you know, when the world changes, it's not always clear. But yes, they know what I used to do, and they can probably see I'm doing similar, but they wouldn't necessarily know, I think, is the answer.
Almost, what do you want them to say? So when they're answering the question, what are the key bullet points you want them to hit?
I'm probably doing some interesting stuff. I think it's important to do interesting stuff. Otherwise, I think doing interesting stuff with products, services, and communications, I mean, they wouldn't necessarily think it's interesting, but I think it's important to do interesting things, yeah. Interesting new things, because the world is constantly changing. So if you're not changing with it, it's going to get very stale. I mean, I think actually one of the biggest challenges for anyone in a job is that the nature of jobs is they often try and commoditize you. They try and make you more and more efficient at what you do, you know, because that's how, you know, a big organization makes more profit. It finds ways to turn humans into more and more like machines that fit into a box. But at the same time, we've got a world that's changing, and those humans have to be ready to completely reshape their skills for the new world. So there's an interesting conflict there, that we're being sort of sanded down into the same old box that can generate lots of profit for an organization and as a known unit. At the same time, you know, we need to be ready to change because the world is changing. And that's a difficult conflict, actually.
I guess my next question to you is, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
From the hip, I'd just say listen more. Listen. I think it's not always a strength of mine, but when you really listen, you learn a lot. And don't always assume you know the answer. Probably also be more politically astute is probably the best advice that I've not always taken. Yeah.
Next question. What's one thing that you couldn't live without?
I think my bicycle, actually. It allows me just to get everywhere in London and everywhere, anywhere, also with kids, without really ever having to get stressed by a tube or a bus that's late I don't mind taking the tube, but I don't want to have to depend on it to get somewhere. You know, I mean, that's a terrible thing to have to do. So I think a bicycle.
And then last question for me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and why?
I don't know, weird is a new word, actually, I think. I'm noticing it in all sorts of places. I mean, I think I'm really normal, but I'm not sure that everyone else does. I'd say I'm probably about 6 out of 10 normal, I'd say. And so 4 weird. I mean, I've got a 4-year-old son who's everything, and he's non-verbal at the age of 4, which is a bit weird. And everything he does is a bit different. And that's proper different, really. You know, he likes to sleep underneath the bed. He'll you know, doesn't like chocolates. He does lots of the things that ordinary kids do. He does something completely different, you know. So I don't know, that's proper weird in a way, but... I think 6 out of 10. Other people would probably put it higher, but I've never understood why people have to conform to feel comfortable. I just think you've just got to do what makes sense to you at that in the scheme of things. And actually, riding a bicycle is something that's considered very weird. You know, when I was age 20, there was the notion that you'd ride a bicycle rather than have a safe, secure car around you, you know, which prevented you from accidents because it was so strong. But in a world that was much more car defined, you know, when I was growing up in the sort of 70s, 80s, and it was weird being on a bicycle. Weird people cycled, you know, and now everyone does. So I think weirdness is just a matter it's just a question of, you know, prevailing orthodoxy, really. How you fit in with prevailing orthodoxy.
Yeah, I guess on that point, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I feel like we learnt a lot and we got a lot of food for thought about lots of different things. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'd happily do it again. I feel like there's a very easy to talk to, and I hope it was concise enough.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.